Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith's panel again. And again, I'm still on location down in East Texas, down at the Galveston National Laboratory. We're going to be talking to someone whose interest in the Ebola virus goes back to the 80s, long before you and I had ever heard about it. And this person is Dr. Tom Geisbert. He's a professor of microbiology down here at the Galveston National Lab. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the story of your interest and your knowledge and your expertise in this particular nasty virus, how on earth did you become a scientist?
I guess it's just that, you know, all through school and, you know, childhood all the way up through high school, biology and chemistry were always my best classes. I always had an interest in the outdoors and nature, so I was, you know, biology was obviously something that I was interested in. I actually grew up in an area very close to the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Fort Detrick, Maryland. And at the time, that was one of only two biosafety level 4 laboratories in the United States.
But you didn't know what that meant in those days when you were a little kid.
Well, I sort of did because my father was a building engineer at USAMRID.
All right.
That's the acronym. And so that's where I grew up. And it's kind of an area in Western Maryland where Virginia, West Virginia, and Maryland all come together. And here in Texas, it's hard to comprehend because you can drive all day and never get out of Texas. And so, I mean, I tell people I lived in West Virginia, drove through Virginia to get to Maryland, to Fort Detrick, to go to work every day. So, you know, I went to college, got a degree in biology, started out at USAMRID doing electron microscopy, and, you know, went there largely because my dad was the building engineer, and that was kind of how I got my foot in the door. And that was at a time where, you know, the economy probably wasn't real great, and it was great to have a job. And but I love science, and always have loved science. And fortunately, I didn't come from maybe a family that could, you know, even then an education, a PhD costs a lot of money. And so ended up in a program that the Army had. I was a civilian, where I could go to Uniformed Services University to get a PhD. But really kind of got my start there at USAMRID in working for Peter Jarling in a biosafety level 4 lab, and again did a lot of electron microscopy, and we were working on a number of different biosafety level 4 viruses, not really just Ebola, Lassa fever and some other things, and we were also studying other viruses, not just biosafety level 4 viruses, but we were actually working with a virus called simian hemorrhagic fever virus, which was a BL2 virus that...
Which is the same as the influenza virus, more or less.
No, it's a little different. It's the same classification.
Right.
But it causes a disease in non-human primates very similar to what Ebola or Lassa fever, some of these diseases, would cause in humans. And we were interested in studying the pathology and the pathogenesis of the coagulation disorders that are hallmark features of Ebola. And that was one of the things that I was working on back in the late 1980s when I was in Peter Jarling's lab. And it just so happened that there was a outbreak of what was thought to be simian hemorrhagic fever in a group of non-human primates, cynomolgus monkeys, that had been brought from the Philippines to the United States to a quarantine facility. When animals come into this country, they're quarantined. And they were put in this quarantine facility in Reston, Virginia, which is a stone's throw from Washington, D.C., and also not very far from Frederick, Maryland, where USAMRID is, where I worked. And so samples were sent up to us to confirm that this was, in fact, simian hemorrhagic fever that was causing a die-off of non-human primates at this facility. And we cultured the virus, actually, in our BL3 lab to try to confirm what it was. And because I had expertise in electron microscopy, Peter and I decided that it would be good for me to take a look at this in the electron microscope to get a picture and confirm the morphology. And I didn't find simian hemorrhagic fever. I found long filamentous structures that turned out to be Ebola virus, the Reston species of Ebola virus.
And that was already known?
No. Ebola virus was known, but not this species.
Okay.
Before this, Ebola virus had come from Africa. All the outbreaks had come from Africa.
Right.
And all the virus was thought to be endemic or occur in Africa, but nowhere else. And this was the first time it had been reported outside of Africa because it came from the Philippines. Right now, we think that this strain may not be, or species is a more accurate term, the Reston species may not be pathogenic in man, but you won't find many scientists that want to stick themselves and find out and right. have an accident with it. So it's still classified as a biosafety level 4 virus. But what happened...
Well, do you find any evidence in the Philippines of people being sick with this particular virus?
No, there's a few people that have seroconverted, so they develop antibodies to the virus.
All right.
So there is speculation.
So there's been exposure.
There's been exposure.
Just not sufficiently... virulent
right.
to be impacting health.
So what came out of this is that a writer, Richard Preston, found out about this, and he wrote an article in the New Yorker magazine, which he later wrote the book called The Hot Zone, which was a number one bestseller. And
it was a movie, too, was it not? No.
They spun off a movie, bought the company, 20th Century Fox, bought the rights to the book, and another company that made the movie Outbreak found out that you could come in and, under the Freedom of Information Act, and interview government employees, and they kind of beat them to the punch and didn't have to pay anything for it. I got an autographed copy of The Hot Zone. Richard made several million dollars.
All right.
So that really catapulted my career, you know, being the co-discoverer of that virus and getting some publicity during the mid-1990s because of Richard's book. And that really spawned my interest in Ebola and certainly jump-started my career.
And that was very early on in your career. I mean, you were just hardly out of graduate school.
Yes, it was very early in my career. But it created an interest. And like I said, at the time, I think I kind of look at Ebola research pre-9/11 and post-9/11. Before 9/11, when I was at East Amherst, again, actually before 2000, there were not many biosafety level 4 labs in the United States. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, their mission has really always been outbreak response. And at USAMRIID, we did have a mission that was developing countermeasures, medical countermeasures, vaccines and treatments to protect the warfighter, because it was thought that the Soviet Union was developing, the former right. Soviet Union was developing Ebola and Marburg virus. Marburg virus is the sister virus to Ebola, as bioweapons. And a gentleman named Ken Allebeck had defected to the United States, I think, in the mid-1990s, and testified in Congress that the Russians were looking at developing these as weapons. So that was kind of when I worked for the Army. That was kind of the mission, is defense and, you know, making sure that we had vaccines and treatments. But that was Ebola. There wasn't a ton of money for it, and it wasn't the only thing we worked on. I mean, we had a lot of other projects right. that we were working on, and you know, I'm a virologist, and so when we had the outbreak of the HANA virus, you know, the Sinombre virus in 1993, mid-90s, you know, we responded to that. Anything time something came up, we were responsive. So it wasn't like we totally focused on Ebola, but Ebola was always my biggest interest. And then I think, you know, post-September 11th, there was clearly an investment in biological threats, and Ebola was categorized as a Category A pathogen, now a Tier 1 pathogen. And all of a sudden, funding...
Tell me about that for a moment. Tier 1, 2, 3, 4, is this... Well, Tier 1 is about as bad as it gets.
And right. And the government, the federal government, NIH, HHS, have categorized agents into categories or tiers, both actually. And this is ranking pathogens on... basically a threat, not really, not just really a biological threat, but it's based on the, well, it is a biological threat, but not just as it's a bioweapon or something, but just an overall threat based on, you know, mortality rate, based on
right.
Things like, do we have vaccines or treatments or not? You know, I mean, if you have a vaccine or treatment, then, you know, something isn't going to quite
threat.
Be a
threat. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So Ebola and Marburg viruses were put on the Tier 1 list because, for a number of reasons, high mortality rates, and one of the big reasons is we don't have any licensed vaccines or treatments.
That was the history, and then you continue to do academic work on this, and now we're in a position where, you know, you're a poster child almost for Ebola studies. Tell us what you're trying to do right now. What is your sort of mission right today that's changed from, say, 5 months ago?
Today, our mission is to develop and further improve and optimize some of our best vaccine and treatment candidates against Ebola, and hopefully in time to respond to the current outbreak.
So There is no vaccine. That's the first point, right? I mean,
there's no licensed vaccine, but there are vaccines now that are moving into phase one clinical trials. I can explain this process. It's complicated, and I can try my best to explain it if you want.
No, no, but I mean, the bottom line is that there are experimental vaccines
that protect non-human primates.
Right, yeah, precisely. So you could, in fact, I was looking at one of your recent papers, and the title was lovely: Ebola Therapy Protects Severely Ill Monkeys. So this is obviously a step in the right direction.
Right, so basically a lot of this work goes back to my days working at USAMRIID before I came here, and then I've brought a lot of those projects into academia. And again, you know, we've been very fortunate that the National Institutes of Health has provided funding for us to develop, you know, different vaccines and treatments and show that these vaccines and treatments can protect animals, and that's part of the process of having a vaccine that could eventually be used in humans.
And in a situation, it probably hasn't developed here. I mean, it seems to me, just as a lay person reading quite assiduously the BBC, all these other sources that I get, it's not easy to contract Ebola. You've got to really get down and dirty, if I can use that expression.
You're correct.
Yeah.
It's difficult, and it's really... There's no evidence. There's a lot of discussion about does it float through the air, and I can assure you, it's, you know, from the data that we have today, as we're conducting this interview, there's no evidence that this virus is transmitted through the air as small particle aerosol, the way that we think about, say, a virus like influenza or measles.
And why? What's the difference between a virus that can, in fact, transmit in that way, which seems quite reasonable, against this Ebola virus, which is it too much oxygen kills it off? I mean, what are we talking about there?
I think it really has to do with the pathophysiology of you know, how the virus grows and where it grows and the pathology of the virus. So the viruses that are transmitted through aerosol are viruses that usually grow and like to grow in the cells that line your upper respiratory tract. So that it's, you know...
So it's right there.
There's a logistical issue there. Ebola, that's not the cells that it prefers to grow in. Ebola really, you know, either through mucosal exposure... exposure usually occurs with close contact with somebody who is infectious, but it's body fluids. So blood, feces, urine, you know, things like that, very close contact. And, you know, we all have a tendency to touch something, and then what do? You put your finger in your mouth, or you touch or rub your eye.
No, I remember a Swedish study years ago where they put some form of luminescent bacteria on people's rear, on their behind, and, you know, it fluoresced. You know, within hours, the whole body was fluorescing.
Right.
You know, you scratch your backside and then you scratch here.
We actually train lab workers here with fluorescent dyes.
Oh, you do?
To show them all the things that they've touched that they shouldn't be touching.
All right.
So it's just, that's human nature.
So whereabouts is the Ebola virus mainly concentrated in the body?
It gets into your blood, and the first cells that it infects are things like, really your first line of defense, things like dendritic cells, macrophages, monocytes. And then through the blood and through lymph, the virus ends up getting into things like liver, spleen, adrenal gland. And, you know, it's really the macrophages that are the key. And it's kind of hard to fight off an infection when your first line of defense is knocked out.
Yeah.
Lymphocytes are a very important cell type. And this is a cell that, these are cells that make antibodies. They're cells that destroy foreign antigens or pathogens. And we're trying to study and understand the process of how this happens. But while Ebola doesn't infect those cells, so it doesn't grow in those cells, it can cause, indirectly, it can cause the death of those cells. And it happens very rapidly. So it's kind of hard to fight off an infection, again, when the cells that are responsible for protecting you are dying.
They're already damaged. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here at the Galveston National Laboratory in Galveston, Texas. I'm talking with Dr. Tom Geisbert, who's an expert on Ebola. He's been studying this for 25, 30 years almost. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. To everyone's surprise, 3 years ago, scientists discovered our sugar receptors aren't exclusive to the tongue.
Our guts can sense sweetness, too. The stomach, intestine, pancreas, and even our airways.
Scientists got pretty excited about what this meant for diabetics. Could drugs target these receptors to help people with type 2 diabetes?
This is the most common form of diabetes when the body no longer makes enough insulin or stops responding to it. We need insulin for our cells to take up the glucose in our blood and use it for energy.
One drug called NuMet is promising. It's now in phase 2 clinical trials and targets receptors in the intestine. NuMet binds to sweet receptors there, activating the release of incretins. Incretins stimulate the release of insulin, which then allows our cells to take up the sugar in the blood.
This mimics the natural signaling process triggered by sugars, and it's fast and direct. Discovering this signaling process in the intestine cleared up a 50-year-old mystery: how eating glucose triggers significantly more insulin than injecting it directly into the bloodstream.
When the sweet receptors in the intestine detect sugar, they trigger adjacent cells to make a glucose transporter to take the sugar into the cells. The faster the sugar is absorbed, the more signals are sent to the pancreas, and the more insulin is released. Thus, understanding these alternative taste receptors can help us develop effective therapies.
NuMet will also help the 4 million diabetics in the U.S. who can't take metformin, the leading type 2 diabetes drug. As the number of Americans with diabetes climbs to 6 million, the demand for additional medications will rise with them.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Dr. Tom Geisbert from the Galveston National Laboratory in Galveston, Texas. And we're talking about Ebola and why it's not easy to contract Ebola by someone sneezing in the room, because the viruses don't, in fact, inhibit the upper respiratory tract like, say, the flu virus. And so it's not easy to get. But once you've got it, of course, it seems to be quite devastating. I mean, 70, 80, 50%, I don't know what it is. But you do see that the people who are in the front line now, the medical staff that have been going to Africa, and even in those in the United States, even in Texas here, these are really susceptible to be contacting the disease because they're in touch with vomit, feces, urine, all of this business. What's going to be, then, you think, the best line of defense?
I think, you know, probably a multi-pronged approach. I think clearly we need to address the situation in Africa, stop it at its source.
Yeah.
And if you look at the situation
in
Africa,
President Obama is stating, I mean, it seems a non sequitur. I mean, it's so obvious, but a lot of people just say put up barriers and it'll go away.
That's a political question, and I'm not a politician, no. So I don't want to talk too much about that. But I think that it does make, we've got to stop it in Africa. And it's hard to contain if you can't stop it at its source. And I think that if you look at the situation in Africa, you have the three countries that are affected. So Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. They're three of the poorest countries on planet Earth. They're resource poor. This is part of the reason why it's been so bad there, why it's spread so bad there. A lot of my friends have gone there to you know, help fight the outbreak, and so I hear firsthand accounts and see pictures of, you know, how grim it is. And, you know, what we call a hospital here is not a hospital there. I'm not saying that every place in Africa has bad hospitals, but those three countries that are resource poor, you're talking cinder block buildings in some cases,
right.
You know, the triage system and people coming in contact with other people that are infected. And, you know, I think historically these outbreaks have occurred in Central Africa, and you have some groups that are fantastic at responding. The CDC, the humanitarian aid organizations like MSF, World Health Organization, but they were overwhelmed this time. The outbreak occurred across a very large geographic area. It popped up, you know,
and
multiple
in very
places.
Remote areas. Where you
very remote areas.
Get an Interstate 10.
Exactly.
You go 400 miles.
And
for a few hours.
And the quality of medical care is nowhere near what we have here in the United States. And so I think that that's contributed. And then cultural practices. I mean, burial practices. You know, where they touch the body. And so I think this is new to West Africa. And I think we hear Africa and we think that it's all the same, and it's not exactly. And I've been to parts of Central Africa before, and one of the things that they've done there that I think is great is a public education system. When I was there, they had this little team of dancers that, like, put on this little skit, and they would go from village to village, and they would show people what happens. Like, you know, if you touch, you know, if you find an animal in the forest, because bushmeat is popular there, and that's one of the ways that the outbreaks initially start. You know, bats are a reservoir. They carry the virus. Some a primate, a non-human primate, gets the virus. A hunter then comes and gets the primate and through the butchering process or something, yeah, you know, is contaminated and goes back home and everybody else gets infected.
So they put on plays.
They put on plays. And they demonstrate that don't do this.
Yeah, right.
And then they also, with the burial practices, they show that you, this is not what you do.
But, I mean, that's got to be a tough sociological
it is.
Experiment.
It is.
People bury people differently.
Right.
Let me go to the people who do get infected by the virus. Are we discovering any people, like with the AIDS virus, there were certain people who just had natural immunity? Is that an area of research that down here in the laboratories in the US and around the world people are looking at? Does it even exist?
I think it's an open question. There have been a few published studies about asymptomatic cases. I don't think we honestly know a lot.
It's too early.
It's something that people are very interested in. The other thing is there's clearly host factors. We're all genetically different. And, you know, even in an outbreak where you have 90%, some of the outbreaks where there has been 90% case fatality rates, you have survivors. Now, there's several reasons why we think that some people survive. One of them is the way that you become infected and how much virus you're exposed to. So the more virus that you're exposed to, the more likely you are, you know, going to have a bad outcome. But all things equal, we also know that it is likely that there are some people that are genetically, their genetic makeup is such that they will survive. And there have been at least two studies that I'm aware of that actually linked genetics, so a certain allele that you different people have, with either survival or non-survival.
So that preliminary data is now known and it's out there.
Yes. Not from this particular outbreak, but from previous outbreaks.
Before.
So clearly there are some people who probably are predispositioned to survive.
Now, the form of treatment that you read about, and I'm just reading it as a lay person, that you can take the serum from people who have been infected and recovered, and then give this to patients who are in the middle of their health issue. Is that going to be more and more likely as an immediate response?
I think it's an immediate response because there's not a lot of other options, quite candidly. It's controversial.
Why?
Because we're not really sure if it works or not. Because as scientists, we like to control every experimental condition.
You don't have time in this game.
Right. And so I'll just briefly talk to this. The idea came up during the 1995 outbreak of Ebola Zaire in the former Zaire in Kikwit, where there were seven or eight people, and they transferred blood from people that survived to people that were infected. And after the fact, when some researchers started looking into it, it looked like some of the people that were treated were going to survive anyway. I think like seven of the eight people survived. So that kind of created some controversy. So when I was at USAMRIID, we actually did a study in a BSL-4 environment where we can control every condition. And we took non-human primates that had survived Ebola, and we took the blood from those animals. So these animals had even been boosted, so they had, you know, decent antibody titers. And we transferred that blood into animals that we then infected with Ebola, and they did not survive. Not one of them survived. So I think the jury is out. There is a lot of variables. And when you look at the people that, you know, Dr. Brantley received a plasma or serum from a survivor when he was in Africa before they flew him back to Emory, his blood has been used to provide antibodies to quite a few people, but I think
all of whom have survived.
Correct.
In North America, but
right.
Maybe.
But they've also got other kinds of treatment. First off, you're talking about most of these patients have either been in Emory or the Nebraska Medical Center, and these are two of the designated, you know, high containment hospitals in the United States. So you're talking about really skilled people, the physicians and the medical teams there, and they're getting the best medical care on the planet. So you're not just talking about getting serum or plasma from. Yeah. So they're looking. They're constantly monitoring your blood, and so they can tell. If, you know, they can give you fluids if you're dehydrated. They can look at your electrolyte balance and replace things that you're losing. And keep in mind that most of these patients have gotten experimental treatments, one of two, either ZMAP or TKM Ebola, that have protected non-human primates.
What are these again?
ZMAP is the treatment that Dr. Brantley and Nancy Wright-Ball received. ZMAP is an experimental drug. It's basically a cocktail of three different monoclonal antibodies that are directed against the Ebola virus surface glycoprotein. And the glycoprotein is just this spike-like structure on the surface, and that's kind of, I like to use the Velcro example. It's kind of the little, you know, hook
that
grabs onto a host cell, and that's how it gets in. These antibodies are developed to basically block that process.
Could they be for all sorts of different viruses?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, and, I mean, this is sort of what would be the holy grail if you could actually do this.
The other product is called, it's made by a company called Tecmira, and the trade name is TKM Ebola, and it's basically a small interfering RNA. So what it does is it interferes with the genetic information or code of the virus, basically what we call the mRNA or the messenger RNA. So this is basically the genetic blueprint. This is the set of directions or the recipe for how the virus makes protein.
Okay.
And so that blocks that. So if you can't make protein, you can't make competent virus. Both of those drugs, ZMAP and TKM Ebola, can completely protect monkeys if you give it to the monkey even after exposure. So they've actually, the physicians that have used these drugs, and they've only been used on limited cases, basically the patients that came back to the United States.
Right.
I think maybe one or two cases or several cases in Europe. But they request these are not licensed, but they request a compassionate use authorization.
Right. It's one of these experiments when you take a placebo or you take a drug and then you find, hey, the placebo is doing a lot better than the drug, and you stop the experiment.
Right? Right.
So in this case, you permit the experiment to continue.
Right.
Right.
So if it looks like the drug's working, you know.
But so in fact, the bottom line to what you've just said then is that, you know, who knows quite the degree to which taking serum from one person to another is useful. In fact, you suggest from your own studies with primates that that's probably not useful.
I mean, if you look at the non-human primate data and you extrapolate that to the patients that have been treated, while we cannot say that convalescent serum doesn't have purpose and maybe it didn't, you know, very well could have played a role. If we look at the non-human primate data, it suggests that probably the experimental treatments like ZMAP or TKM Ebola may have had a bigger role. And then I also think you cannot underestimate at all the quality of medical care. I think that is huge. I mean, you have the ability to put people on, you know, ventilation. You have the ability to do things like dialysis. I mean, this isn't done in third world countries like Africa.
Well, I mean, in fact, the patients, the two young ladies that were here in Texas that went to Emory, I think they went, was dialysis part of the treatment? I mean, are they going through all of these things?
I don't know.
Sure, but I know.
I think they were both released, and I don't think either one of them got to the point where, you know, that was required. But there were patients at Emory that did have a lot of medical care.
We've run out of time, Tom Giesbert. I want to thank you very much for... you must wake up in the morning and suddenly realize, my goodness, these things I've been doing for 25 years and so, and now everyone's interested. You should get a pay raise, at least, I hope, right? Thank you very much for
thank
being
you.
On Science Studio. And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting this whole thing together again, and I'd like to thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.